Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another episode of the Mango Bobo and Donovan podcast. Mango Bobo and Donovan's Void. We're back today in the garden because we're going to need a lot of serenity today.
Should we start with like a breathing exercise?
We're going to start with a yoga exercise.
Yeah.
We're going to do 30 minutes of sun salutations and then we're going to get into... today's episode, you know, we're going to address the elephant in the room,
right.
Which today isn't trauma, but it is trauma, actually. But
yeah.
It's not quite trauma. It's mostly trauma, but it's war. This is our first World War III episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is our second unprecedented event of our life. Actually, our third, if you count climate change.
Yeah.
And speaking of which... We haven't been doing as many video episodes because of climate change. So between the floods, the storms, and now the war, it's a little bit difficult to come out into the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I do want to talk today about war.
Mm.
We might be kicked off of every platform after this episode. We might. You might not see us again after this episode.
Yeah.
We do want to talk about war in the broader sense,
mm-hmm.
but also in this very specific context where both a war and a genocide are taking place. We have a double whammy.
Yeah.
And I want to talk today about humanity's lust for war. And I use the word lust intentionally because it is a lust. It's a lust. We, as a species, we have a lust for war. Mm. And we have a lust for genocide. And I want to talk today about what is it that war does for us, that we keep coming back.
Yeah.
Like toxic dick.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say we because actually... It's not me and my people.
Right.
But it's a lot of other people.
Yeah.
There's just a lust for war.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about why that is and what war represents.
Yeah.
And what is the meaning that we derive from war? Because clearly...
Mm-hmm.
We gain a lot of meaning from war. Well, we gain a lot from war. Camaraderie, we gain meaning, moral clarity.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll talk about all of that. But I want to talk about that. So currently there's a genocide happening in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And to call it anything but that, I will fight you.
Yeah.
Because it's a genocide. And in the midst of the genocide is the broader war. How did we get here?
Do you want like a
really your opinion.
Boring historical answer? Or do you just want like speaking to the raw emotion of it all?
Let's speak to the raw, because I think we sort of all understand, or maybe not.
Yeah. We've all seen an infographic.
Right? We get the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Yeah.
We get colonialism. We
yeah,
know what
yeah.
settler colonialism is. We get Islamophobia. That's also a big part of the... But what is the raw emotion? What is... In the context of the human condition, how did we get here?
Well, like you said, war is a force that gives us meaning.
Mm.
And I think that we really simplify humanity when we view humanity through the lens of beings that just want to be happy. Because I think deep down we desire so much more than just happiness.
Including suicide?
Yes, we desire meaning. And war, sadly, gives people's lives a lot of meaning.
Mm.
And I think that we talk about war through the lens of it being an event or through the lens of it being a tragedy.
Yeah.
But we never speak about war for what it most fundamentally is, in my opinion, which is a drug.
Let's talk about it.
It's a narcotic. There is a high every time a war breaks out.
Mm.
That to not acknowledge would be like blasphemous. Like it's insane. Yeah. We all get a little bit high off of the events. And the reason why is because it allows us to basically surrender our individual consciousness and our individual morality and just surrender it to the tribe, surrender it to the cause,
to the collective.
It to the group. And that allows you to basically unburden yourself of your individual morality.
Yes.
Unburden yourself of the feeling when you see a dead child.
Mm.
Unburden yourself of the feeling when you know that you are personally doing something morally wrong.
Mm.
And I think that war almost always happens once a society has become so alienated and lonely and cold.
Yes.
Because the warm feeling of, like you said, moral clarity and moral absolutism and feeling like a part of something and feeling like a perfect victim, and that feels very, very warm and cozy pressed up against the backdrop of this cold and alienating world that we've created.
Right.
Anytime people feel disenfranchised and humiliated and lonely and alienated, a war is almost bound to break out in the same way that a forest fire is bound to happen in a place that is dry and arid.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
It's the perfect premise for war.
So the first step, because I wanted to talk about war not as an event, but as a process.
Yeah.
So the first step to war is individualism.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So we atomize people.
Yeah.
We separate them and alienate them from themselves as well as from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And now they crave the sort of attachment that comes from being a part of a collective.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's the first fertilizer for the soil of war's individualism. Mm-hmm. What is the next one?
Okay, so once that has happened,
you're
fully primed for the drug of war, basically.
Yeah.
And the best analogy I can come up with is in the same way when you take Molly and you're in the club and you have your fucking arms around the shittiest club promoter you've ever met, and you feel as if that's your best friend.
Mm.
That's what war does.
Right.
It allows you to hold hands with the most insane genocidal maniac that has just pure hatred in his heart.
Yes.
And in that moment, when you're high off of that drug, it could be the post 9/11 moment in America. It could be this moment right now. It could have been Germany in 1936.
Mm.
You can feel a connection with the most insane, shitty person that you've ever met. Someone that you wouldn't spend 5 seconds with during peacetime.
Right.
You will swear is your best friend during war.
So collective suffering is also... It's ingredient number two in the process of war. Collective suffering, so that you and I, because we are both suffering, because we've both been atomized, and we both realize, wait, you're also suffering.
Yes.
And now we become comrades.
Yes.
But camaraderie is not friendship. And we'll talk about that later on.
Yes.
But camaraderie is the perfect substitution for an atomized individual who doesn't have the emotional shelving.
Yeah.
To create and maintain friendship. So we settle for camaraderie.
Yeah.
And in camaraderie, we create a common enemy.
Yes.
Because we have to make sense of our collective suffering. Mm-hmm. And so now we create the common enemy.
Yeah.
So now step three begins, which is dehumanization.
Yes.
So we dehumanize the common enemy in order for us to justify the mass murder that we're about to inflict on them, and that we deep down want to inflict on them. Because we want to make them feel how we feel.
Yes.
And whether that reason for dehumanization is valid or not, it's usually never valid.
It never is.
It's never valid.
And this is actually the step even before dehumanization, which is myth-making.
Oh,
the creation of the mythical past is the core tenet of fascism.
Yeah.
Everything was perfect until these people came.
Mm.
And it's so fascinating that people swear that they're being nationalistic and displaying a love for their people before they go into war.
Yeah.
Because the conditions of nationalism that always precede war are actually the destruction of a culture.
Explain.
And the reshaping of that culture into a thing that can be primed for war. In every war that has been between two ethnic groups that have a very, very long shared history, such as Palestinians and Semitic Jewish people, there is always a destruction on behalf of the state of all of the shared history that those two people have together. So,
oh, right,
because
right,
we can't
right.
have that.
Yeah,
we need
yeah.
you guys to be mortal enemies. So the yes. first thing we have to do is destroy the entire history
yeah.
of peaceful coexistence. Mm. Under the Ottoman Empire, in this current situation, in the place that this current situation is occurring,
yeah.
there was peaceful coexistence mm. between Palestinian Semitic people
yeah.
and Jewish Semitic people.
Yes.
In the former Yugoslavia, when Serbians and Croats and Muslims went to war,
mm.
under a communist regime and before that, there was history mm. of peaceful coexistence
yeah.
between all of these people. But what always happens, and I'm going to use the war in Yugoslavia as an example, is the state actively destroys any proof of that history
mm.
and they get focused on the narcissism of minor differences.
Yeah, let's talk
about
that.
So when the war broke out in Yugoslavia, for example,
yeah.
the Serbian people started only using Serbian words. The Muslim people, who never used traditional Muslim words prior, basically, started insisting on using Muslim words, the Croats. And that now becomes the basis of the new history
mm.
that the state can exploit to pit people against each other.
Right.
All of the mosques and Serbian neighborhoods were destroyed to mm. just wipe out the history. And I think what's really sad when cultures go to war is they're wrapped up in this drug
mm.
and they really think that they're fighting for their culture
yes.
and their people.
Yeah.
And they are often actively destroying that rich history
mm.
to basically give their lives away to some bullshit narrative that the state has constructed
yeah.
at their own expense.
Yeah.
You know? So before yeah. you can dehumanize someone, you have to destroy all history
mm.
of peaceful coexistence, because that's the real threat to the state in that moment.
And that's really interesting that you say history needs to be destroyed in order for war to take place, because
yeah.
something I find really fascinating is that war is very rarely played out between two groups that are very, very different.
Right.
You know, war is always between siblings.
It's the narcissism of minor differences.
It's the Hutu and the Tutsis.
Mm.
It's the Ukrainians and the Russians.
Yes.
It's the Jews and the Palestinians. It's all, not always, but very commonly.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is always sibling rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from a tension that is actually innate to the human condition.
Yeah.
Which is that, and Gabor Mate talks about this in his new book that I'm reading,
mm.
where he talks about the developmental needs of human beings.
Mm.
And he talks about when you're born as a human in this world, you're essentially born with two conflicting needs.
Mm.
On one hand, you have the need for attachment. You need community.
Mm.
You need to attach, especially to your caregiver, in order to be safe, in order to even just for your brain to develop in healthy ways. You need to be attached to your caregiver and also to a greater community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's developmental need number one. On the other hand, we also have the need for authenticity,
mm.
which is the need to be an individual, to be an individual self, to mm. stand out. The need to assert yourself against the crowd. So right off the bat, the second you hop out the womb, you have these two needs.
Mm-hmm.
The one is to fit in into a crowd
mm.
and be attached to this collective crowd.
Mm.
The second is to stand out against the crowd
mm.
and to assert your own individual will.
Mm-hmm.
And those two needs are at odds mm-hmm. inherently. And I think the conflict that is born
mm-hmm.
when two groups that are really, really similar have to coexist is that on one hand, you crave the sort of melting into the background of the community.
Mm.
But on the other hand, that melting into the background of a collective is really suffocating and mm. you want to be an individual.
Right.
And so what you do then, when you're in a space with a collective group of people that you're very similar with, is you find reasons why you're so different.
Right.
And the human mind will come up with any type, it will find anything.
Yeah.
To justify why me and you are different.
Yeah.
Why me and you are actually two separate individuals. Because
yes.
we are tortured by the gravity of collectivism.
Yes.
we're at the same time, we're also tortured by the weight of individualism.
Yes.
But we need both, and the two needs are conflicting, and the consequence of the clashing of those two needs is war.
Yes.
Always.
And, yeah.
And that's my theory on war.
You know, another thing, just deep in the trenches of the human condition, that quite honestly disgusts me, and is part of the reason I struggle to want to be alive sometimes, is that humans are by nature opportunistic.
Explain.
And the sad part about war is that it is an incredible opportunity. We always find ourselves in very stagnant socioeconomic conditions. It could be the Indian caste system, it could be the Western capitalist system. You can find yourself just being a loser with absolutely nothing going on and feel completely stuck in life.
Yeah.
And war is the only thing that can take that bum-ass nigga you went to high school with was really creepy around women and turn him into a war hero that is in a montage in the Super Bowl set to an Eminem song.
Yeah.
It is the only thing I know about that can do that. And sadly, humans are deeply opportunistic. We are oftentimes discontent with our lot in life because of predatory capitalism and the structure of Western society inherently. Yeah. And we view war as this opportunity to get something that we never had before.
Which
to
is
get
purpose,
to get status, to get women, to get... And that is the thing about humanity that honestly, like, disgusts me.
Really? Why is that the thing that...
Because... opportunity cost. Like, what are you risking? Like, I understand being discontent, and I believe in revolutionary violence. This is not me. Like, I understand dying for a cause. I understand dying for your people. I understand dying for what you believe in. Dying for your own selfish need for self-advancement.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the average guy in America that wants to join the military in, like, the South, when you look at the average guy is in, like, happy to go into war right now in Israel and the IDF. Are these the best of us?
Yeah. Or is it someone who is unemployed?
and this is how I feel about all war. When you look at countries where wars break out, and I look at these people foaming at the mouth with this bloodlust to kill the enemy, my first thought is that if this person could get a small business loan to open a car dealership, would they be doing this? This, like we started saying, this is birthed out of a deeply broken society, a deeply alienated society, a society in which all of the social bonds have been broken.
Yeah.
You know, the Greeks called it anomie. It is when you are so broken and disconnected from humanity, you have no friends, you have no culture, you have no social institutions. At that point, you just have this desire to watch the whole world be engulfed in flames.
Right.
That is when a society starts decaying, and that's when someone says, fuck it.
Right.
I would rather just die. I'd rather die in a glorious way.
And do you... Sorry, go on.
Yeah, a question I really wanted to ask you about is violence. Because this is something that I struggle with constantly.
Yeah.
As someone who, one, understands the true definition of violence, which is not just defining violence by violence that occurs during change.
Yes.
But defining violence as the everyday shit that goes into keeping things the exact way that they are.
Yes. The violence of the status quo.
Exactly. That is the full definition of violence. Like, white supremacist Western media will always only acknowledge the violence that occurs through change, when people are trying to change their material conditions, but there is a violence every single day. Every single day, when an old Palestinian woman has to go through 7 different checkpoints to get her chemotherapy, that is violence. Every day a child is born in, like, disgusting material conditions to the point that they don't see a few, that's violence.
Yes.
Every failed kid by an education system is violence.
Yes.
Every day
they have to wake up in an open air prison.
Exactly.
That is violence.
That is the full definition of violence.
Yes.
And I believe in revolutionary violence to end further violence. But the reason why this confuses me on a philosophical level is I no longer believe in utilitarianism.
Yes.
I no longer believe in this idea of the means justify the ends. Not because it's not true, but because the moment that you choose when to dictate whether the pros outweigh the cons is arbitrary.
Yeah.
And that's where I really struggle with violence and figuring out which violence I support and which violence I don't support.
Yeah.
And I actually think that we're actually very qualified people to talk about this because we are living in the remnants of the previous apartheid state to fall.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And we know the full breadths of what gets birthed out of violence, of instability.
And I actually wanted to talk about this because I see a lot of Nelson Mandela quotes going on. And white people love Nelson. Oh, my God. Yeah. White people in the West, they love Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
They really, that's their king.
Yes.
And the reason they love Nelson is because they've created this myth. So because in order to uphold whiteness, we need cognitive dissonance, right?
Absolutely.
And the cognitive dissonance, right? How do I even frame this? The cognitive dissonance around Nelson Mandela is that he was a very peaceful person.
Yeah.
It's, oh, we love Nelson Mandela. He was a peaceful person. He ended apartheid peacefully. Are you niggas out of your mind?
They don't talk about the Nelson that was wiring bombs in Johannesburg. Oh. They don't talk about the Nelson that had to go underground and
people think here in South Africa apartheid was ended peacefully? Are you guys mad? But that is the myth white people had to tell themselves in order to uphold whiteness through their cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
Because they know. Yeah. They know just as well as we do that the only way to beat them at their own game is to play their game, which is violence. Mm. So here's the thing, though.
You get a fucking air horn, bars.
Listen, here's the thing. Settler colonialism, but just colonizers generally. But actually, let me talk about settler colonizers.
Mm.
The only language they speak is violence. Mm. And I say this as a black South African who has to live with them every day. This is their language.
Mm.
They obtained this land, not obtained, they stole this land through the means of violence.
Mm.
They stayed on this land through the means of violence. And they fought for this land through the means of violence. Violence is their only language. It's the only language they understand. And therefore, it's the only language they respect.
Mm.
So the dilemma now comes in, because in order for us to engage them, we have to speak their language.
Yes.
But that is inherently an act of self-betrayal, because we are not violent.
Exactly.
And in having to speak their language, which is to say match their energy, stoop down to their level, we corrode parts of ourselves. And the question then is that worth it? Because I look now at the post-apartheid state that is South Africa, and it's really not even a post-apartheid state, if we're really being honest about it, because we had to speak their language. And in having to speak their language to liberate ourselves from the settler colonials, we had to corrode our spirit.
Yes.
And after we corroded our spirit to gain our own liberation, we weren't able to maintain our liberation because our spirits were corroded.
Yeah.
We've stooped down to their level and we are now also violent.
Yes.
Violence, we've inhabited their language of violence.
Yeah.
And the question then becomes, well, is that worth? Because I'm looking at Palestine right now and I'm like, listen, guys, I live in a post-apartheid state. And it's very different. It's very similar. South Africa and Palestine, very similar, but
and
also very,
very
different.
Yeah.
You know, very similar in the sense that it's some white
but
people
no
came, took
our
land.
But no one in the world can speak on this better than South Africa.
That's the thing.
Yes.
Some white people came here. They took our land. They insisted it was theirs. They forced us for it. They put us in prisons. They enslaved us. They treated us like animals.
They gave you
port. They dehumanized us. They did all the things they're doing to the Palestinians. The only difference, and it's really tragic, is that our colonizers needed us for slave labor. Israelis don't need Palestinians for slave labor, and that makes their fight extra hard, and that means their violence needs to actually be amplified.
Yes.
We had a means of negotiation, which is like, listen, bitch, I want my land and dignity, and you want my labor.
Yes.
So we have to negotiate.
Yes.
You have to give me some, and I have to give you some.
Yes.
what is the negotiation when I want my land, but you want nothing from me?
Absolutely.
What negotiation could possibly happen when I have nothing to give you? When people ask for peaceful revolution, but there's no negotiation to be had, because in order for a negotiation to take place, two people must want something from the other. When I want my land from you, but you don't want anything from me, because you don't even view me as a human.
Yeah.
You called me an animal.
Yeah.
On TV.
And it was your president.
It was the pres. You said you called me an animal.
Yeah.
What other language, what else is there to do but violence?
Yeah.
You know?